come on Monday. Worked out nice because I had midwinter break from school this coming weekend with Friday and Monday off. So I could go on a trip like that and not have to miss any school, really. Yes, it would be a John Verstegen's conference, and we're looking forward to being at that meeting. So, again, there won't be any class next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Following Sunday, we'll resume this and keep moving, okay? So, that's for the benefit of those folks online as well. So, lesson 225. You should have in front of you notes for lesson 225, the AV1611. Early sales, and we're going to be looking at the subject matter of market diversity. And that's not right, actually. I changed that. That was my original subheading. The correct one is variety of formats and market structure is what we're going to be looking at. So I have changed that, just so everybody is aware of that. Okay. So in lesson 224, we began looking at the topic of early sales by considering the early 17th century Bible market. In doing so, we consider the following 3 points. Number one, we looked at the printing capacity of the king's printer. Number two, we looked at Bible production before the AV or before the King James. And then we looked at financing and printing rights in the third point. Okay. When discussing point three, we learned that the king's printer, Robert Barker, paid a large sum of money to secure printing rights for the AV. Our very own Mike Erspommer has contributed the following research to calculate how much Robert Barker paid for the patent to print the AV using the CPI inflation calculator. Mike was able to provide the following. So remember last time we encountered two discrepancies. One source said that he paid £3,500 and another source said he paid £4,000. Okay, and we were kind of spitballing very generically and generally saying this is a lot of money, and we hadn't really done any calculations on like what that might equate to in modern times. Okay, so Mike used the CPI inflation calculator to kind of do some digging on this. So let's look at, so I'm quoting here from an email that Mike sent me on the 5th or this week. So let's look at the quote. Enter the amount £3,500 in the year 1760, so this is entering that into the CPI inflation calculator, and you will get the conversion in today's value in pounds at £885,000, 710.17, I'm assuming, okay? Then convert that to dollars, and you get $1,118,715.15. So that's a lot of money, right? Then Mike says, I tried entering 1650 and got the message that there was no data prior to 1760. But you could do a calculation based on the average percent increase per year since 1760 and calculate back 110 years to 1650. That would give you an approximate value today. At any rate, £3,500 in 1650 would be worth over $1 million today, maybe close to $2 million. Okay, so that's the first thing. So if you want to comment on any of this, let me know.
So going back to 110 years, you're just guessing because there is no inflation data. We don't even know if there was inflation during that time. I assume there probably was, but we don't know how much.
Okay. Then in a second email, Mike stated, the average inflation rate per year since 1760 was 2.12% per year. But what was it between 1650 and 1760? To make the calculation from 1650 to 1760 simpler, I used an average rate of 2% per year from 1650 to 1760. So adding 2% of 3,500, 70 per year, right?
Yeah.
70 pounds, that'd be 70 pounds. We should probably put the pounds on there in front of 3,500 as well as in front of 70 pounds per year to for the additional 110 years from 1650 to 1760 would add, I'm assuming again pounds, right?
Yeah.
7,700 pounds to the 3,500 to get 11,200 pounds by 1760, which would translate to £2,834,272.54 today. Okay? That is a conservative number, since I just use a flat 2% of 3,500 pounds or 70 pounds times 110 years to get the 7,700 pounds. To do a proper calculation, you would have to add 70 pounds per year to get 11,270, then take 2% of that, 225 pounds and 40 cents, I guess, and add it to this, so this gets a little complicated, right? 11,270 to get 11,495, take 2% of that and add it, etc., for 110 calculations, and let the computer do it for you. However, we don't know what the inflation rate was between 1650 and 1760. We can only guess. It may well have been less than 2% a year. Maybe it was an average of 1% a year. That would give you 7,350 pounds by the year 1760, which would be 1,859,991 by 2024. Excuse me. I think we can safely round the total to 2 million pounds. So I think approximately 2 million pounds today would be a conservative estimate in the ballpark anyway. So Mike's obviously put a lot of work into trying to guesstimate exactly how much in today's money the King's printer would have had to invest. And that's just to secure the rights to print the text. So if that's true, then he's got to outlay somewhere between $1 million and $2 million in today's money before he's even done anything. Before he's printed a single word, a single line, or sold anything, does he have a extremely high outlay of money just to secure the right to print that text? Okay, look at the next point. Recall that Graham Reese and Maria Wakely presented two different potential figures in their essay, The King's Printer's Bible and Common Book of Prayer Monopoly. They had a 3,500 pound number and a 4,000 pound number. According to Eric Nye's Pounds, Silver to Dollars Historical Conversion of Currency, so this is another website where you can enter the year that you want to start with, the current year, and then how much you want to calculate, and it'll tell you an estimate, okay? So we're going to compare this here. So according to Eric Nye's Pounds, Sterling to Dollars Historical Conversion of Currency, the value of 3,500 pounds in 1611 equates to $1,252,159.70 in 2024. Likewise, 4,000 pounds would equate to $1,431,039.65 in 2024. So we have a variety of numbers here. We've got numbers that we can calculate using Eric Nye's calculator, and then we have the numbers that have been supplied by Mike in his research. So regardless of which number is correct, Mike Erspommer's or Eric Nye's, the King's printer Robert Barker spent an enormous sum of money for the right to print the AB. This hefty financial expenditures to secure printing rights proved detrimental to Barker's enterprise and forced him to take on partners, which ultimately proved devastating to his business fortunes. So we talked about that. So imagine your business structure is such that before you've done anything that you can recoup money and sales from, you have to pay, let's just keep it simple, $1.5 million just to secure the rights to do that. Okay? So is that a lot of money before you've ever done anything? Okay? So you can see where doing this would have put him in a disadvantage economic situation before he even starts to print and sell anything. Okay, so the last lesson, let me stop there. Does anybody have any questions or comments about that? Mike, what do you think of Eric Nye's number versus the one that you came up with?
I don't know how he could calculate if there is no inflation data prior to 1760, but he did, so I don't know.
So if you go to that website, by the way, so this, if you're at home, you can click this link, pounds, sterling, and dollars, and it'll take you to the website. And then there's a little blurb there that says, if you click that, it'll take you to his explanation of how he did the figuring. And it's like way deep into the math. Like, I tried to understand it, and I'm like, yeah, okay, I'm done. His numbers better than anything I would ever come up with. So it is interesting, though, to compare Mike's numbers with his. And the bottom line here is, even if we don't know exactly how much he paid, we know it was a huge amount of money that was a financial setback to him economically before he even prints a single King James Bible. Okay? Anybody have any questions or comments before we do? What's that?
The government?
The crown. So it's interesting to think about.
The king
wants. It's either the crown that's getting it, or it's the Church of England. You know, because who? I've read different stuff about this. Some people think that the money went straight to the crown. Other people think that the crown authorized the Anglican Church to work in its interests, and that the money possibly went straight to the Anglican Church. I don't know if anyone knows for sure. The other option is it went to the Stationers' Company, which is a company. You remember, hopefully, that when they did the Committee of Final Review, they met at Stationers' Hall. Stationers' Hall was a company that was related to printers and stuff like that in England at that time. So that's a third option, that possibly some of the money went to the Stationers' Company. The bottom line is, it's speculation. I don't think we know for sure who got the money. And the money might have been divided up between all three. We don't know. What we do know is he had to pay to secure the rights. Okay?
Is this the selling copyrights without the copyrights name in it?
Okay.
It's like a gray area as far as copyright.
So that's a great question. Okay? Modern copyright, the way we understand it, did not exist in 1611. I've got a whole chapter in my book out there on the table, the King James Bible in America, where I talk about copyright. What this is more like is they're buying a patent to print the text. It's an exclusive patent to print the text. Okay? So no other printer could print the text when it was first published, because the print rights were only given to one printer, and that's Robert Barker, the King's printer, because he paid to have the custodial authority to publish the text. So he is acting as a state agent on behalf of the crown when he publishes the text. So he does not have the liberty to change things of his own decision making. You see what I'm saying? So it's a unique situation, Ken. It's a little foreign from the way we understand modern copyright, but it is essentially a print right patent that is granted to him to publish the text. And then he retains that patent, and that's why they go, I know you weren't here last Sunday, but that's why they go to court later on, because he has to take on other people to help him because of the financial burden of this. And so what ends up happening is who really has the patent right to publish a text becomes disputed. And so it ends up in a British court in the 1620s. So I know it's a lot, but does that answer your question?
There's a lot. The copyright question is, who has some in your King James Bible, it says copyrights aren't a thing, you know, right on the label, but then they have a list of copyrights.
Okay, so we have to think about this. So you have a defined King James Version that's done by Bible for Today, I believe. So their, and the other thing I would say is This crown patent only extends to places of jurisdiction under the British crown. So in America, once we secure independence from the crown, we start publishing the King James Bible here in the United States because we're no longer under the jurisdiction of the British crown. So even today in 2024, that the King James text is still under what's called crown copyright. But that Bible was published in America by a specific publisher who added notes and definitions and other stuff. They have copyrighted not the text of the Bible, but all those additional notes that they've added to that Bible. Does that make sense? Anyone else have a question about that? All right. Now, again, so the legality of all of that, I've got a whole chapter in that book where I go through all the history of that copyright stuff, okay? All right. So let's get to some new material now. So in this lesson, we want to continue looking at the early 17th century Bible market with the goal of understanding the, quote, early sales of the AV. In order to accomplish this task, we'll consider the following points. So what we want to look at today is a variety of formats and sizes and the market structure of this under a monopoly system. This was a monopoly because only one person paid the rights to what? To print. Okay? So let's start looking at this. So first point here, halfway down page 2 roughly, understanding the early 17th century Bible market. We will once again be following the 2009 essay of Graham Reese and Maria Wakely titled The King's Printers, Bible and Book of Common Prayer Monopoly, to frame our discussion of this topic. So the first subpoint is variety of formats and sizes. The entrance of the King James Bible into the Jacobin Bible market served to complicate an already confusing situation, according to Reese and Wakely. Graham Reese and Maria Wakely cover this point in their essay titled The King James Printers, etc. We already read it, so let's look at the quote. The Bible market was a complex one, which had become no simpler with the advent of the King James Bible. Four main variables were involved in printing purely biblical texts in the Jacobin period. Biblical texts came in different packages, versions, fonts, and formats. Okay? By packages, we mean that the Jacobin reader could demand the complete Bible, Old Testament, Apocrypha, and New Testament in a single edition. Alternatively, the reader could buy the New Testament by itself. Or third, the third part of the Bible, containing five consecutive books of the Old Testament canon, viz. Job, the Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. So the first issue again is what they are calling here is what package or format, right? So you could buy a complete Bible, Old Testament, Apocrypha, and New Testament. You could buy a standalone New Testament, or you could buy what was called at the time the third part of the Bible, which was a small section of the Old Testament that was being published at the time. Okay. So, first of all, you've got those three packaging formats that you can buy it in. Look at the next point, page 3. As for versions, fonts, and formats, a Jacobin reader might want, but not necessarily get, the Bishop's Bible, the Geneva Bible, which, as we know, came in several subversions, and from 1611, the King James Bible. These versions would have to cater to two separate markets, one wanting biblical text in Roman type, the other wanting it in English, i.e. block letter. Okay, so now you have a further complication. Could you buy a Geneva in Roman or block letter? That one that Mike has here is Roman type. Okay, so you could buy a Geneva Bible, you could buy a Bishop's Bible, or you could buy after 1611 a King James Bible. And you had your pick of fonts. Did you want it in Gothic font or block letter font, or did you want it in Roman type? Okay? So that's another issue now that you got to keep in mind. The market would also demand a range of formats, everything from mighty folio editions, right down through quarto, octavo, and how do you say this one?
Duodecimo,
which would have been the smallest one. And in the case of the New Testament, down to 16 and as little as 24 in, I'm assuming this 12S I think means 12 shillings. But I might be wrong about that. Of course, whole Bibles. So you have, so you got three options: King James, bishops, or Geneva. You have font options: Gothic font or Roman type. And now you have a folio, a quarto, an octavo, a duo, whatever it's called. Okay? And then you have the whole Bible with Old Testament, Apocrypha, the New Testament, or the third part of the Bible. So is that like a whole bunch of different ways you could purchase the Bible at that time? Okay? Of course, whole Bibles were printed in and only in the largest formats: folio, larger and smaller, quarto, octavo, and duodecimo. New Testaments were not printed in folio at all, seldom printed in quarto, and only once in duodecimo. In fact, the New Testament market was dominated by octavos, with 15 Jacobin editions, and in 24 and 12 with 14. So I have to be honest, like, some of that I don't even know what that means. Okay, I've tried to figure it out, and I'm like, yeah, okay, moving on. Okay, it's just not something that I was interested enough to spend the mental capacity to try to figure it out. I just know, are they selling the New Testaments in smaller sizes than they are the whole Bible? And that just makes sense, right? Today, can you go to a bookstore and buy a pocket New Testament and you can fit in your back pocket? Teeny little thing. I mean, you probably need a magnifying glass to read it, but you could buy it in that size if you wanted to, okay? So this is not just to do with cost, for a New Testament folio would be in probably lean, and a Bible in 24 and possibly fat. So in other words, there's considerations of how big or small these different sizes would be. So in other words, the biggest size, the folio, you don't want to just print a New Testament in folio, because it's going to be thin. It's not going to be worth the paper and the binding and the stuff that you're putting it on, right? So you put it in a smaller size. Now the interesting thing about that is, when you put it in a smaller size, now are you making it so that the common man can buy it for it's going to be cheaper, and can they buy it for their own use at home? Okay. So the Bible market or production became at once simpler and more complex from 1611 onwards. In the matter of versions, it is not far from the truth to say that just as the Bishop's Bible, though not the Bishop's New Testament, died with Elizabeth, so the Geneva Bible, as the King's printer edition, did not survive the reign of James. So in other words, are those options going to start falling out of favor, and are they no longer going to be printed? Okay? Over time, the answer is yes. Of the phenomenal 51 editions of the Bible brought out from 1611 to the ending of James's reign, only 7 versions of the Geneva Bible, compared with 24 published from the beginning of the reign to 1610. So, in other words, once the King James comes out, does the number of printings of the Geneva Bible decline precipitously compared to the period from when James was coronated as king to 1610? Okay. In short, output of Geneva Bibles collapsed very swiftly after the birth of the King James. With a final blaze of glory in 1615, 1616, with the printing of 4 Geneva Bibles, culminating in the last gasp black letter folio in 1616. It is no surprise that the discontinuing of Geneva editions coincided with the end of the three-way partnership of Bill Norton and Christopher Barker. So we talked about that. That was the litigation thing. Okay. Nor is it any surprise that it also coincided with the start of a period when Bill and Norton, who would have been happy to manipulate the market in the King's interest, became Barker's effective successors. After that, the King's printers produced no further editions of the Geneva Bible in the STC period. I'm not even sure what they mean by that, but the bottom line is the Geneva's slowly stopped being printed. The answer is yes. Okay, next point. Rees and Wakely furnished their readers with impressive publication statistics to demonstrate the comparative demand for the AB and the Geneva Bible after 1610. These statistics challenged the long-held narrative that the AB was not well received by the English world of the early 17th centuries. For more on this topic, see Lesson 222 on the early reception of the AB. Now let's stop there. Do you remember, hopefully, from Lesson 222, we looked at sermons and how preachers of sermons slowly started to change over from the Geneva to the King James, and how that challenged the standard narrative that the King James was not well liked after it was first published. Another data point to consider here are the sales figures. The sales figures suggest that the King James Bible was very much being sold at fairly strongly in the decade after it was first published. Okay, so let's look at this. The case with the King James was otherwise. After 1611, it quickly superseded the Geneva Bible, the fall of the latter coinciding with the early and most intense phase, of King James Bible production. In the period after 1610, Bible production rose sharply from the pre-KJB average of 22 to 23 editions per annum, so that would be per year, right, to 32 to 33 editions per year from 1611 to 1625. So, in other words, once the King James comes on the market, are there more editions per year printed? Yes or yes? Yes, okay. This remarkable acceleration of production conceals a yet more remarkable statistic, that in the four-year period from 1612 to 1615, inclusive, 23 editions, or an astonishing 5 editions per annum, cascaded from the presses. It is difficult to interpret this bulge in production as anything other than strong demand for the King James Bible, with continuing through much weaker demand for the Geneva. So, let's put this another way. If they're not selling these Bibles, are they going to invest the capital to print them? They're not. So does the King James Bible within the first 5 years begin easily outselling the Geneva by publishing statistics? Okay? So again, that challenges the narrative that has been long held by some. However, it would be sensible to add that given the uncertainties of any new market, the King's printing house may have underestimated demand or kept print runs relatively small in order to maintain liquidity. So in other words, are they going to put out a massive run and expend capital, or are they going to print what they think they need, sell it, and then print more? Okay? Certainly a new edition in a given format and font would have been produced only when stocks of the previous edition in the same font, same format and font began to run low. Only then would fresh capital and labor have been invested in the new. In fact, the printers may have been surprised and gratified by the speed with which editions sold out, and certainly editions in two of the most popular formats, fours and eights, sold like hotcakes, with 10 editions of the former and 7 of the latter in the 4 years of the bulge. So that means that the smaller editions, the non-folio sizes, are they selling fast? Okay. Alternatively, the bulge may in part have been Barker's desperate attempt to offset lack of capital by following the ruinous course of producing stock, which he then sold at a discount in a vain attempt to keep his creditors at bay. So, we already know that Barker spent a huge amount of money to have the rights to do this. But the bottom line is the production and sales stats suggest that between 1611 and 1615, are there a ton of King James Bibles being published, and are they selling out relatively quickly? Okay. All the data we have seen thus far applies to the publication of complete Bibles, i.e. Old and New Testaments, as well as the Apocrypha early on. But early on, there was also a robust market for King James New Testaments that cannot be overlooked. Now, you understand, right? What's going to be cheaper? A whole Bible or just a New Testament?
New Testament.
So if I'm a person living in the early 17th century England and I have limited funds, am I going to possibly find a New Testament more attractive and more affordable if I want to buy one? Okay, so you can't just look at the whole Bible, you have to look at the New Testament as well. So much for the Bible from 1611, but what about the New Testament in the King James period? The Bishop's New Testament continued to be produced after 1611, seeing seven editions, all in octavo, the final edition appearing in 1619. The Geneva text fared less well with only five editions, the last appearing in 1616. However, four of these editions came out in the smallest formats, 2 in 24, in 12s, and 2 in 16. So perhaps filling a gap in the market for small format non-King James Bible New Testaments. As with Bibles, so with New Testaments, production of the King James Version leaves the Geneva and Bishop's Bibles in the shade before driving them to extinction. With a total of 16 editions of the King James Version in the years from 1611 to 1625, of which the majority were the smallest King's printer formats, with 8 editions and 24 in 12s and 2 in 16. Now, that makes sense. If you're going to publish those, do you want to publish them in the smallest, cheapest, most inexpensive format that you can put them in so that people will buy them? Okay? So while not popular in our day, the third part of the Bible was another format that the early AV was sold in. Having discussed aspects of production patterns for the Bible and New Testament, we should perhaps add a brief word about our third package of biblical text, the third part of the Bible. This, as we have said, contained five books of the canon, i.e. Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. We do not know why this tranche, right, of text was adopted as a publishing proposition, but two Geneva versions had appeared in 1580 and 1583, perhaps to tap into a market where buyers could only afford a small format New Testament and a third part. Now, let me stop there. I have seen since I was a kid Bibles, pocket-sized Bibles that had they had the New Testament and the Psalms.
Right?
I
have one of those.
Some of you might have one of those. I haven't seen one of those lately. Somebody might still make those, but that's kind of the same idea as what we're talking about here. Okay. let's see, where do we leave off? However, that may be, no other third part appeared for over 30 years until the 1616 edition in 24 and 12s, this time in the King James Version, and only one had been given out in the Jacobin period. So, there's a lot of data there, but what it suggests, when you look at the publishing data, is that after its release in 1611, what Bible is far and away outselling the other Bibles? The King James. So again, that challenges this narrative that exists that the King James was not well-liked or well-received until 1630. Okay, any questions before we move on to the next point?
Can you define edition for me again? Is it said, you know, there was this many editions this year, this many editions that year.
So, I think the way they're using the word is as follows. You typeset, you print 3,500 copies, you stop the press. That's an edition. You sell out, you make 3,500 more, that'd be a second edition. You sell out, you make 3,500 more, that's a third edition. That's my understanding of the way they're using that word. Okay?
So if they had a lot of editions per year, they were having a good year.
They were having a good year. And again, what Reese and Wakely are suggesting is that the reason they're doing that is to control costs. Because he has a huge expenditure on the front side that puts him behind the eight ball financially, and so he's trying to manage costs by publishing in smaller lots, and if he's got to do multiple editions to make demand, he's willing to do that. That's my understanding of the picture that emerges here.
Now, having a monopoly, you would think, and then you factor in supply and demand, you think that they could inflate the price, but...
Yeah,
I mean, you have that option. I mean,
you would have the option, but you still have to... And I think the way they accommodate for that is the diversity in size, right? So the big folio that's like this big, you know, 19 by 11, massive thing, no one's going to buy that for use at home. Hold that one up, Mike. Can I?
What did we say that, what did we decide this was?
A quarto.
Here's a Geneva quarto, okay? This is a facsimile reprint of a 1560 Geneva. You could see where somebody could buy that for personal use at home. But the folio is going to be, you know, massive compared to this in size, and therefore more money. And so the King's printer, to try to recoup the money and to expand the market, he's not just going to sell it in folio, he's going to start putting it in our quarto, octavo, and other sizes. And then not only that, he's going to just do New Testaments, then a third part of the Bible, so he can diversify and target certain people for what they might be able to afford to buy. Okay, that's my understanding of what's kind of going on here with the publication and the sales. Does anybody else have any other comments before we get to the last point? Now that's important though, okay? The reason that's important is because it shows you that was there a robust market for personal use for the AV? There was. There obviously was, or they wouldn't keep, the publisher would not have saw fit to continue to publish so many editions in a given year, okay? All right, market structure. What page is this, 5? Market structure, monopoly, and book sales. So since the AV was produced under monopoly conditions, i.e. one printer, the King's printer had crown authority to publish the text, it impacted its early production. In the next section of their essay, Reese and Wakely apply William St. Clair's theory of what happens to book sales when a given work is produced under monopoly conditions. Okay, so this is again quoting from their essay. Now Bible production, and by implication the sale, distribution, and readership of Bibles, is the grand exception, as he recognizes, to William St. Clair's otherwise persuasive theory of the political economy of book production under monopoly conditions. The private monopoly ownership of all texts from Bibles to ballads in perpetuity, as in England in 1744, produced a stable and prosperous industry in which authors, publishers, and manufacturers and distributors were increasingly well rewarded, enabled substantial new works to be carried into print, but concentrated the benefits of the richer on the richer members of society, delaying and restricting access to others and holding back the majority from access to modern knowledge. Why did that happen? Because, says St. Sinclair, monopoly producers had every reason to place their wares as high on the demand curve as they could. So, Mike, you were sort of already thinking these lines here, okay? As high as they could, i.e. they would always be tempted to bring out an edition in a larger or more expensive format than a smaller or cheaper one. A publisher with exclusive copyright will maximize his financial returns if he moves down the demand curve in a series of discrete trenches over time. That is the classic behavior of the monopolist. For example, he will start by selling few folios at high unit cost, and then progressively smaller formats in larger numbers at lower prices. This is precisely what happened with the production of the King James Bible. Barker's headlong plunge down the demand curve in large access to spanking. That seems like a weird word here, but anyway, it's very British. A spanking pace. Okay. The first folio edition appears in 1611, and in 1612, the first quarto and octavo. So the 1612, you already have. So the second year, you already have quartos and octavos. Those personal sizes, like I just showed you. And then in 1617 came the first of the innovative duodecimo editions, a cheaper format which to a degree displaced the more expensive quartos. As for the New Testaments in the King James Version, Barker and his cuckoo partners, not my words, theirs, rather than starting with larger formats in the fullness of time going to smaller, began after a fresh start with the 1611 duodecimo in 1615, and with the smallest format they used for the New Testament, 24 and 12s, they went up to 16 in 1619, and only in 1621 did they reach the vestiges, the vestigiousness, right? Vertigious, whatever, heights of octavo. In other words, here's the point. Far from skiing down the demand curve, they shot up it while taking good care almost annually to revisit the bottom to produce yet another edition in 24. A clear case, assuredly, of demand-led production in which the publisher's insatiable appetite for cheap New Testaments drove the presses. So in other words, if they aren't, my understanding of that, of what they're saying is this. If they don't do that with the smallest, cheapest editions and sell them in volume, is it going to lead to problems with their higher, more expensive editions? Mike Erskpommer, that's the way I understand that. Is that the way you understand that? Okay. So, to this extent, King's printers buck the trend in what William St. Clair regards as the natural behavior of producers exercising monopoly rights. The reasons for this were probably managerial and political. Managerial factors may be as follows. We recall what William Taylor, Barker's land agent, said about his principal's disastrous business practices in the early KJV period. Taylor, answering Boham Norton's chancery petition in 1612, so this is back to the litigation we talked about last week, averred that Barker's shortage of money and poor management of his office before 1618 caused him to, quote, sell his books in the said office for present money before they were half printed and finished to half the prizes he might otherwise have sold the same, and having in that manner sold all the books he had in the said office, and therewith so furnished and provided the stationers that they need not buy any more books from any office for a long time. In a business where possession of stock and canny handling of it were of the essence, as Bill and Norton understood to perfection, a printer could simply not afford to sell him or herself short and then undercapitalize, compound the problem by spending more money printing more editions, perhaps selling them at a discount, and consequently suffering still more acute problems of liquidity. So in other words, they help keep themselves liquid by having these cheap, small New Testaments that people can buy. That keeps money coming in so they remain liquid for their other endeavors. That's the way I understand that. Mike?
Yeah, I think.
Okay. As for political factors, the king's printers were under an obligation to carry on the king's business insofar as it related to book production. And of course, that meant, to a large extent, producing all those Bibles. So seriously was this taken that obstacles to the printing of the Bible or anything else of interest to the king could lead to official interventions. That was hardly surprising, as versions of the Bible were prime vehicles for conveying the ideology of the monarchical church. And for instance, Cranmer's prologue to the Bishop's Bible, which asserted that the King's Highness, being supreme head, next under Christ of his Church of England, hath approved with his royal assent the setting forth thereof. And for all the true and obedient subjects, that should be sufficient reason for them which accepted the vernacular Bibles without further delay, reclamation, or resistance. So in other words, is it an act of political expediency to make sure that people can buy what the king wants them to buy? Okay. Much more of this was made in the preliminaries to the King James Bible, perhaps in part because one version of the Bible, the Geneva, made nothing of it at all. But then the King James Bible was like so many of James's literary projects, an investment for consolidating a distinctive official national church. The dedication to James and the translator's address to the reader have much to say about the special duty of the kings to protect and promote the church, as James had done as conveyor of the Hampton Court Conference, as the principal mover and author of the King James Bible, and as a monarch determined to tread a path between the scrupulosity of the Puritans and the obscurity of the Papists. Above all, the preliminaries to the King James Bible asserted the position of the Anglican Church as a monarchical church, and it elided obedience to the king with obedience to God. So in other words, if you obey the king, you obey who? God. Printing the King James Bible with these preliminaries was in effect printing a representation of cardinal data about James and the Jacobin state. Printing the King James Bible in the widest practicable. I think what that means is that anybody could have it. Number of formats to reach the greatest number of readers was then a political imperative, which, if economic motives had not been present, would have overwhelmed any tendency to restrict output to the most expensive editions. So there you have your answer, Mike. Okay, so you've got economic things to consider, but you also have the political aspect of this to consider, which is why they acted as they did. Okay. Any questions about that before we conclude?
To me, it just sounds like the government was behind it. I don't know.
Well, they were.
Yeah.
Let's just talk about that quick. For us as Americans, this seems very foreign to us. You know, imagine if our government today was trying to actually get the Bible in print. Seriously, imagine if part of the state policy of the American government was to have the Bible printed.
That's right. That's what they're trying to do now.
So this is a different time. This is a different era. The considerations are different. The politics is different. The economy, the economic aspect of it is different. And so we look at it today and we think, man, that seems weird. But by the standards of the day, this is how you did things. Okay? Any other questions or comments about that?
You could kind of compare it to government contracts today, or a contract to supply things to the military, and it inflates the cost so much.
Yeah. In a sense, does the printer have a government contract?
Yeah.
He does. Is the king the one who authorized the project, the head of the Anglican Church? Does he want this Bible to be put out for the people? And so the printer, acting on behalf of the crown, is he going to adjust business practice accordingly to seemingly do what the crown wants done? Which might cause them to act or behave in ways where people in other markets who have a monopoly would not. because they have other considerations to weigh as they're publishing these editions, not to mention the economics of it, the cost, and all that that we've talked about during this lesson.
And that's why the other ones went out extinct, because they didn't have time to do theirs. Really? Right?
Well, you could argue that in a sense that if they would have continued to be demanded, there probably would. And what ends up happening is the Geneva Bible continues to be printed on the continent, no longer by the king's printer, but at Antwerp or somewhere else. And so now a foreign supplier, if you wanted a Geneva Bible, you could only buy it as an import because the king's printer had stopped making them.
I can't imagine
how much those were. Okay. And then that leads to a whole bunch of other stuff related to, you know, that's all that. Now that's obviously still kind of political, because now if you want a Geneva Bible, you can't go to buy one from the king's printer. You're gonna have to buy one from somebody else who's printing them and importing them, and that's where you end up with. Eventually, you end up with King James Bibles published with Geneva footnotes or marginal notes, because, like we talked about in Lesson 222, the Puritans' main objection to the King James Bible was not the actual translation. It was the fact that it lacked the Geneva notes. So then some other foreign printer sees a opportunity in the English Bible market to supply a King James Bible with Geneva notes. So that's what they do. And I think there were three different editions of those printed and imported, if my memory is serving me correctly, having looked at the catalog. Okay, so let's look at the conclusion. So in the next lesson, which will be not next Sunday but the Sunday after, we will continue this discussion of the early 17th century Bible market by considering the following points. We're going to look at the ecclesiastical sales. That would be sales to Anglican churches versus the private sales to individual citizens. Okay? So, we are done a little bit early. Does anybody have any comments or questions about anything that we've covered in Lesson 225?
Do you know who the printer was for the Bible?
It was... I believe it was printed in France. The king's printer never published it. So any Douay Bibles are published on other presses. Most probably on the continent, most notably France, and then imported into England. But there is a market when the king's printer stops printing Geneva Bibles. There is a market for imported Geneva Bibles that presses in Antwerp and other places are willing to do that, to try to sell to people who still wanted that. And then the diversification comes again, as I said a minute ago, with a King James Bible with Geneva notes. Now, James is dead, I think, when that happens, but because we know that he detested those notes. Okay? Any other questions?
Now, didn't the Roman Catholic Church kind of didn't want people to have the Bibles in their hands? I mean, were there, you know, the Roman Catholics out there, you know, they couldn't get their hands on a Catholic Bible, were they maybe,
well,
just to get a Bible, would they?
That's why the Catholics made the Douay Rheims. Because
eventually
the Catholics are brought kicking and screaming to the English Bible market. That's why they make the Douay Rheims, which is thoroughly Catholic in its notes and ancillary materials, to provide for an English speaking Catholic an option to one of these, you know, heretical Protestant Bibles. Of course, in their mind, right? And that's why they make it. They make the New Testament first in like 1587, and then they finish the Old Testament. The Old Testament comes out in two volumes, like just before the King James is released in 1611. So, any other questions or comments? All right, if not, we'll be done 4 minutes early. Appreciate your attention. Just a reminder, next week we won't have class during the 9 o'clock hour.